We've got reassuring news for liberal arts graduates here today. This caught my eye in yesterday's Wall Street Journal. A recent analysis from the Association of American Colleges and Universities, a trade group representing more than 1,300 schools, has found that once people with liberal arts degrees reach their peak earning ages, 56 to 60, liberal arts majors are earning a little bit more than the earnings for people with degrees in vocational fields like nursing and accounting. So and I think the major thrust, the overall thrust of the article is that you may spend some years under-earning people with degrees in the vocational fields, but over time, the evidence seems to suggest, according to this study, that the earnings will ultimately surpass those with vocational degrees. Not to downplay the value of a vocational degree. You can succeed with either one, it would appear. But given the rap that liberal arts degrees get, as a holder of a liberal arts degree, I couldn't help but pass that along. It's Current State here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us today. A proposed plan to build a bus rapid transit system linking downtown Lansing and Meridian Township has many people thinking about the costs and benefits of expanded transit service here in mid-Michigan. While it may be creating a lot of stir, the BRT proposal is only part of a larger mass transit strategy for Clinton, Eaton, and Ingham counties. The Tri-County Regional Planning Commission is preparing to launch a comprehensive study of the community's transportation needs. Officials want to study how neighborhoods and businesses might prosper if the region had a stronger cross-county transit system. Joining me now in the studio to talk about its transit demand and economic prosperity study, Susan Pigg, the executive director of the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission. Sue, welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So you typically do long-range planning all the time at Tri-County Regional Planning. In fact, you've got a report on your website that looks as far ahead as 2040. What are you doing with this new study? What does that explore?
Well, we do long-term and short-term transportation planning. We actually serve as the organization in the Tri-County region, Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton County, that tries to coordinate the planning of federally funded transportation modes, all modes. And so with this study, we've actually merged our concerns and interests in economic development with transportation planning. We have had a number of discussions with transportation planners over the years about the technical need for different modes of transportation. And those are all displayed in our long-range transportation plans. Those are federally required documents. You have to plan ahead to get federal dollars. So we have those, but we haven't had much discussion in the past about how that influences or impacts our local economy. And so a few years ago, a group that regularly convenes at the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission, a group of economic development professionals that serve the area, got into a big discussion about what does prosperity look like for our region. And one of the things that they identified immediately was prosperous regions have a well-integrated multimodal transportation network. And that's become expected of companies when they're looking to locate their firm or expand their business. It's become expected of employers when they seek to expand or increase the number of jobs that they offer. And so we'd like to have a more robust multimodal transportation network across the region, particularly in the area of transit. We know that people are concerned about their capacity to get here and there, where they need to go, where they want to go, without driving their cars.
The Transit Demand and Economic Prosperity Study here is actually phase two of another study, and Tri-County released an initial report on regional transit mobility about a year ago, August of last year. What was the takeaway from that? How does it dovetail with this phase two?
Well, what we did with that was say, let's in one comprehensive place put together an assessment, a list, an overview of everything that we have in terms of the assets in transit. And then you can't help but ask while you're doing that, what would you like to see? Mm-hmm. So when you ask, what do you have? We got that list down.
Is that like a baseline?
That's a baseline.
That's what's out there right now, what we've got to work with. So were you able to theorize at all about gaps in the region's transit service? You kind of suggested you do, because you look at a list of what you've got and you think about what you don't have.
We did. And so does everybody that lives here. They recognize and acknowledge or speculate about where those gaps are. But those identifications of gaps so far have not been what we'll call scientific or engineering analyses. They're not technically robust. They're very personal. I want to get from here to there, and I couldn't do it on a bus. That's the kind of questions or comments that people made when we started our initial a review of assets.
Can you give us an example or two of the one that you heard?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about the ability to get a bus from downtown Lansing out to the Lansing Mall area or beyond, out to the Marketplace Boulevard area in Delta Township. We have heard for a number of years from employers in the DeWitt area, in up as far as St. John's, over in Delta Township, even down in Charlotte, that they can't get their employees back and forth to work at off hours unless they drive. And some of them don't have a car, or a car is expensive. You have to maintain the car, and not everybody has the capacity to drive. We've heard that in the past. We've also heard from senior citizens who are concerned about getting themselves back and forth to the doctors, to shopping, to medical treatments when they're no longer physically able or shouldn't be driving a vehicle.
Doesn't CATA provide services for that population?
Yes, they do. And so does Clinton Transit and E-Tran. But none of them provide services. Well, the sense is that their services are good for what they can offer, but they're not fully funded. They can't offer more to everyone, to every place.
This might figure into the next question pretty good, because part of urban planning involves latent demand. You need to take latent demand into consideration, and this implies future economic development, but also the aging of the population and things like this. Well, we all know we got a baby boomer glut out there and a growing number of a glut of people who are probably looking at compromised mobility in one way or another. Will this figure into the next phase of this study?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You have to look at all of these factors when you look at your transportation network. You can no longer just look at the width of the roadway and assume that it's all going to be cars. You need to consider the needs of the people and where they need to get to. And with this study, we're particularly concerned with the economic impacts of a robust transit network across the entire region. So we're very concerned to look at what employers need, what employees need, what we need as a community to have a more sustainable, robust, prosperous economy.
When does this study start? Has it already started? What's the mechanics of executing the study?
We are just beginning now. We did issue a bid and went through the bidding process for contractors to help us with this technical assessment, and they've been brought on board. We're in the contracting phase right now. Within the next month or so, we'll be establishing an advisory committee of area transit folks, businesses, representative from the chambers of commerce. We're already partners with a lot of these economic development professionals, so they're involved as well.
Leaps at the table, I take
it. Leaps at the table, absolutely. Yeah.
There seems to be a national trend that suggests fewer young people are getting driver's licenses or owning cars, but that might make sense in a very densely populated area. But how might that play out here in mid-Michigan?
That's a national trend, and we've heard and seen information, actual data studies about that nationally. But what we are seeing is that that's occurring here as well. If you poll, and we haven't done it recently, but if you polled, for example, Michigan State University students and asked how many have cars compared to a few years ago, you'd find that fewer have cars. Fewer of them keep them on campus. Fewer of them use cars on a regular basis. Cars are more expensive, and maintaining and keeping them is more expensive. It's a trend that we've noticed locally as well as nationally. Fewer people keep multiple cars and use them regularly, mm-hmm. and more young people expect and anticipate a robust transit network.
How long do you think the study is going to take? And when will you have something to show from all this? Is this a multi-year kind of thing?
No. Well, the study itself is likely to be done within the year. We're looking at a pretty quick turnaround, a rather intense and immediate snapshot understanding of the region's opportunities. After that, the plans to develop and expand our transportation network will take quite a while longer. This study will provide us the data and information that we need in a supportable, provable manner so that we can go forth and seek federal and state funding to support these kinds of developments.
Susan Pigg is Executive Director of the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission. We're talking about transportation planning here in mid-Michigan and the idea of a expanded cross-county transportation network with a particular focus on economic prosperity and economic development. Is the BRT project the kind of project that might down the road result from the study that you're about to embark on?
Well, the BRT project started in 2008 or before with a different sort of bent, a much more specific focus on a particular mode in a particular location. This study is much broader. It's more looking at the latent demand across the entire region and the opportunities for cross-boundary and integrated transit networks. So they're not really tied together, although they're all part of the transportation network in our region.
There are developments out there, though, that I want to run by you just to see how they connect, if at all, to this study that you're about to embark on. The multimodal gateway in East Lansing is a hub for Amtrak and CATA and private bus lines and taxis. You're taking a more of a cross-county intra-county approach with what you're embarking on here.
Exactly.
Though. And these are the BRT, as big a deal as it may turn out to be, is still a smaller scale project. You're really looking regionally here with this.
Yes, our focus, Tri-County Regional Planning Commission's focus, is always regional. We're not really in... We're not interested. We do care about the entire region and all the little parts within it, but our focus is on a regional basis, not on a specific municipal basis.
What do you make of private ride-sharing businesses like Uber and Lyft impacting transportation planning? Is it reducing ridership?
I think that it's shifting ridership. That's the same way that we can look at other kinds of planning that Tri-County Regional Planning Commission is involved in. We're involved in economic development planning and land use planning and environmental protection planning. And with all of those, it's like a spider's web. When you pull on one string, the rest of it moves as well. And whether it shakes off or breaks is a critical concern. So I think that we recognize and acknowledge the growing role of shared ride programs like Uber and the others, and taxi service, and the changes to the kinds of vehicles that we are comfortable using. All of those are factors within our regional transportation planning.
The BRT originally went through Tri-County Regional Planning, as I understand it. What do you make of the disagreements in the community right now over the BRT? Would you have anticipated this degree of resistance and this much heat from this development?
I would have anticipated more interest and concern, more detailed examinations to occur with any kind of transportation development. So Tri-County Regional Planning Commission serves as a coordinator of planning, not as the director or guide. You know, we help facilitate and coordinate planning across the region so that it's interconnected. With the bus rapid transit, that started as a project that was included and considered in regional plans. We have to acknowledge that it was proposed and likely to occur, and that continues to be included and considered in a regional network of transportation. At this point, they're down to the actual design and engineering of the project. They're about 30% into that. So not even a third of the way done with the details of exactly where the bus rapid transit would run within the roadway, exactly how lights would be timed or people would be able to cross streets and such. And that's the level of detail that we do not get into, the engineering detail on the ground. We don't get into that in regional planning. We encourage it and we support and facilitate communications about it, but we don't actually decide it. And so with any project, whether it was the bus rapid transit or a new bus route, the Michigan Flyer went through the regional process a number of years ago, and some people will recall that big discussion. Whenever you get down to the details of it, the community becomes more concerned. And now is that time to listen to and learn about the details.
We're basically out of time, but quickly, I know Deb Alexander is leaving CATA. That is somebody that I assume you've rubbed shoulders with quite a few times over the years. What has she been like to work with?
Deb has been the ultimate professional. I've worked off and on with Deb through the region because of CATA for many years, and she's highly competent, very intelligent, and very committed to this community.
We have been talking about a new study that will examine the costs and benefits of a regular, more reliable transportation network across Clinton, Eaton, and Ingham County. Susan Pigg, Executive Director of the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission. Nice to see you, Susan. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, last week you may remember we learned about a study from the University of Michigan Energy Institute that's generating some controversy. Researcher John DiCicco went against the popular view by concluding that biofuels are not completely reabsorbed by plants.
The amount of CO2 pulled out of the air over this period only amounted to 37%. Of the CO2 that was emitted when the biofuels were burned, instead of covering 100% of those emissions.
Coming up, we'll get the reaction of one biofuel supporter who discredits that study. That's coming up on Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR and AM 870 WKAR, always at WKAR.org. In Detroit, there are neighborhoods where most of the houses have been demolished. Along with knocking down long empty houses that are beyond repair, the city's been encouraging people to buy homes with an eye on making those parts of the city livable again. One couple decided to move from Brooklyn, New York, into an old Detroit house a few years ago. The project has become the subject of a book. Amy Heimerl of the MSU School of Journalism faculty is the author of Detroit Hustle, a memoir of life, love, and home. The home had been empty, save for occasional squatters, for about a decade, and it was falling apart. On Wednesday night, Heimerl will talk about the book at the Schuller Bookstore in the Meridian Mall. Earlier this summer, Scott Pohl visited the now-famous house in Detroit for a conversation.
Well, the first time I stood in the spot looking at it, the house was completely boarded up, and we had no idea what we were going to be walking into. It was a little overwhelming, and we would walk into a house that had no heating, no plumbing, no electrical. Basically needed to be completely rebuilt inside the existing walls. But when I stood back outside after finally touring the inside and seeing the devastation, I already knew I was in love.
See, lots of people would look at that and go, what have I done?
I think there were definitely moments once we bought the house where that was true. But at that time, standing out sort of in a spring bluster, a streetlight comes on, this giant white tomcat walks across the roof, and it just felt like all the signs were pointing toward home.
Why did a white tomcat tell you that you were home?
I don't know. It feels like I was just looking for signs. I think I just read Under the Tuscan Sun by Frances Mays, and she was looking for signs too, so maybe I'd been influenced.
Did your husband share this?
Yeah, so he saw the Tomcat, and he actually saw me out here standing and talking to the house that he named Matilda, saying, tell me if this is, you know, do you want me to live here? Do you want us to do that? If so, say something now. And then the streetlight comes on, and he was just shaking his head, being like, there goes my wife.
Now, I know you call the house Matilda. Why do you call the house Matilda?
My husband, Carl, named the house that after the Tom Waits song, Waltzing Matilda, about sort of an aging old, you know, woman who had great bones and great beauty, that, you know, he saw that in this house.
All right, well, let's describe the house. I see two floors and maybe an attic, sort of a third floor with some windows, red brick, and you've mentioned the devastation inside, and we'll learn more about that when we go in. What kind of shape was the outside in when you arrived here?
So mostly just like this. What we've had to fix on the exterior has been windows. So those were all boarded over. Now we actually have windows. And the roof had to be completely repaired. And sort of the roof line, one of the things we learned about was dentils, which if you look up at a lot of historic homes, they're the little square boxes at the roof line. We have 100 of them, and they all had to be recut out of cedar. Those are things you don't think about when you buy one of these properties.
Oh, my. Well, I'll tell you what. We will get lots of pictures and show them at WKAR.org for people who follow along with us. Let's go on inside. All right, here we are in your entryway. Amy, tell me about this part of the house.
So this part of the house, we actually couldn't enter when we first bought it because the front door was sealed shut. Somebody had beaten apart the front door and then nailed it shut. So we didn't even have a door. We had to go through the back. All of this didn't have doors. We're standing in front of what is now a bathroom. Our contractors added that in. Historic trim out of a church. There was almost no original detail left to this historic house. But a church was scheduled for demolition here in Detroit, and we were able to get a lot of the wood and doors out of it. So what you're looking at right now is all that amazing historic woodwork out of an old 1880s church. So if you come through here, we're looking over to the left in what had been the coat closet and now is a built-in bookshelves. My contractor, Cal Garfield, and I both love books. And so one of the things he wanted to do in renovating this house is bring in a lot of bookshelves. And so this had water running through it. It was moldy. It was falling off the side of the house. And he's restored it and made it gorgeous built-in bookshelves that I'm very excited about. In this room, we have the kitchen and the dining room. This was originally about 5 small rooms. I couldn't even figure out where a refrigerator would go. So one of the few changes we made to the footprint of the house was opening up this space so we could really use it in the modern way with people gathering around this 9-foot island we have. We have a lot of parties in here and people love to just hang in this space. Off of the kitchen, you see a sunroom where my husband's grand piano is. When we bought the house again, that was not going to be salvaged. It was so far gone. Again, water running through it, mold falling off the side of the house. The entire south wall actually was collapsing. So we had to rebuild the south wall. But in doing that, our contractors figured out a way to save the sun porch. And so now my husband's piano is in there and he gets to play.
You've mentioned on more than one occasion here now things that were really, really in bad shape or falling away from the house. Did anything ever actually have to be fully removed from the house in that regard, or were you able to salvage everything?
We were able to salvage everything. That was not something we expected, but in the process, we, you know, didn't actually lose anything.
This looks like a living room area.
This is the living room. So when we first saw this room, we actually couldn't see anything because it was boarded up. You know, it was just dark. I always thought this room was going to sort of be a dark den once we got it done. And then the windows came in, and it was a little shocking how much light was let in and how close to the street we were. So that was a beautiful surprise. The fireplace still needs to be redone. At some point it got singed, so you can see that it's black and needs some work, but that's in process. So I'd say the house is about 95% done, still some details to work on.
All right, so you wrote a book when the house work wasn't quite done yet.
Right, not quite done, but we're at the point where it's like painting, redoing the fireplace, just sort of small cosmetic things. Then we go upstairs. There was a bathroom, which we can look now. It's one of the few places where original detail, the floor, was able to save. But where the bathtub was actually was a giant hole to the basement. So there wasn't actually any plumbing. There wasn't a bathtub. There wasn't a toilet. There wasn't a sink anywhere in the house. So all of that had to be redone. All the fixtures had to be put in. We have a master suite. And so this is right above the kitchen. So just like we opened up the kitchen and dining room, this was also a warren of a bunch of tiny little rooms, including another kitchen and a bathroom. So we opened that up into a master suite. So those are the two big differences. And then above my husband's piano room, I have my work room.
We're talking with Amy Heimerl. Her new book is Detroit Hustle, a memoir of life, love, and home. Well, you have created a beautiful home, lots of natural lighting. We have to talk about a few things like the money involved.
Sure.
Let's start with what you paid for the house.
So we bought it in early 2013 for $35,000. So, and it is a 3,000 square foot brick home in a historic district that is actually on the National Register of Historic Places. So there's many neighborhoods in Detroit where you could buy something cheaper even than that. Most things still require a lot of work, just like this house. I think the price point at 35 was a little higher because of sort of being in a stable neighborhood like the West Village.
So you paid $35,000 for the house. Mm-hmm. Do you mind telling me how much more you have now spent on these renovations?
Sure. The total renovation cost has been about $400,000, which sounds like a lot. But if you were buying a house like this in any city in America, $400,000 would be a pretty stable market value. The challenge is, of course, that it's hard to get loans for that kind of money on a house that you buy for $35,000. The bank isn't inclined to give you loans. Fewer than 10% of homes in Detroit get mortgages. Most sales are all cash, and then the renovations are all cash.
I assume you've gotten to know your neighbors. I would be curious to know what your neighbors say about this house and the work you've had done on it.
They are so supportive and so thrilled, even when we had generators running from sunup to sundown for a year and a half because there was no electrical with which to use the power tools. They were thrilled to have the noise because it meant finally the house was coming back to life. You know, they were tired of having to mow the lawns and board it up and try to prevent squatters. So for them, it's been a huge just relief and to have us here and have this house brought back to life. We did a historic restoration, not just a Home Depot special renovation. We tried to rebuild this house for another 100 years. When we did get the appraised value on it, it was $300,000. So some people are concerned that we're $100,000 underwater. I look at it as in Brooklyn, we could never have afforded to buy. So by coming here, we got an amazing house, an amazing community, and our monthly carrying costs are still lower than they were there. So we come out ahead and we're not trying to flip or sell this house. We're trying to live here until we're too old to make the stairs.
Amy Heimerl teaches journalism at Michigan State University, and she's the author of Detroit Hustle, a memoir of life, love, and home. Amy, thank you. Great meeting you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for being here.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And on Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, Amy Heimerl talks about her book at the Meridian Mall, Schuler Books. Coming up on Current State, the great pianist Yefim Bronfman is making appearances this weekend here in Michigan and showing two sides of his virtuosity. First with the Kalamazoo Symphony playing Tchaikovsky on Friday, then on Sunday a solo piano performance at the Wharton Center. We'll ask him about maneuvering that split personality when it comes to playing the 88 keys. That's coming up on Current State. By the way, Current State's next pop-up stories event is on the horizon here. It's later this month, but I'll just drop this in briefly. We're gathering at the Reach Studio Art Center in Lansing on the 29th. So storytellers and aficionados of fine storytelling, we hope you can plan to join us then. That's a Thursday night, I'm pretty sure, the 29th of this month, Reach Studio Art Center in Lansing. Last week on Current State's weekly environmental segment, we learned about an attention-getting study from the University of Michigan Energy Institute. The Institute's John DiCicco said it found that biofuels are not, as often touted, carbon neutral. That is, the emissions from biofuels, like ethanol, are not entirely reabsorbed by plant life. Biofuel supporters, including our next guest, have taken issue with that report. Let's find out why with Bob Dineen, CEO. I beg your pardon. We've got a different guest here. We were originally going to have Bob Dineen on. Instead, we've got his associate, Jeff Cooper, who is affiliated with the Washington, D.C.-based Renewable Fuels Association. Jeff Cooper, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Mark. Happy to be here.
Let's get one of the most basic red flag criticism on the table first. As we explained, and as Mr. DiCicco acknowledges, the U of M study was partially funded by the American Petroleum Institute. Now, when I asked him about this, he said, among other things, that the work he'd done prior to the API study was already casting doubt on CO2 uptake and biofuels, and that he proposed it to them, not the other way around. What do you think?
Well, and I don't know whether that's true or not. I guess I'd take his word for it. But it certainly, I think, casts a little shadow of doubt over the results and conclusions of the study when the work is fully underwritten by the American Petroleum Institute. You know, oil refiners have a very vested interest in kind of closing the market to competition and shutting out alternatives to petroleum. So,
does the underwriting discredit it completely from the get-go?
Well, no. I think what discredits the study from the get-go is just the kind of bizarre methodology that Professor DiCicco uses. And he's right. He has written similar studies in the past that take this same type of approach to carbon accounting that the rest of the world has really rejected. The kind of standard methods of doing this type of carbon accounting take a much different approach to biomass, crops used for biofuels and bioenergy than Professor DiCicco did.
Well, let's get into the heart of his claims here as a result of his study. It found that biofuels are not carbon neutral. Dr. DiCicco studied Ag Department data over 9 years from 2005 through 2013. Now, the data involves carbon uptake. That's the exchange of carbon from emissions to plant life and back again. Mm-hmm. And according to Mr. DiCicco, flawed computer models that have been used to compute the rate of carbon uptake thus far. This seems to be the core assertion made by his study, and we've got tape of Mr. DiCicco explaining it all. It's a long soundbite, but bear with me. I'll let him speak for himself, and then I'll get your response. Here he is.
Okay. What I did differently was say, well, wait a minute. If a cornfield is already pulling CO2 from the air when that corn is being harvested for cattle feed, for corn chips, going into our food system, however it might go into our food system, just because you then shift some of the harvest to make biofuels, have you speeded up how quickly the corn crop is pulling CO2 from the air? No, you haven't. And so I then went to the field data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and over the period that you mentioned, from 2005 through 2013, I looked at the data on crop growth and yields. I converted that to carbon uptake, which is really just a chemical calculation based on the composition of different crops. And I found that the amount of CO2 pulled out of the air over this period only amounted to 37%, just a little more than a third of the CO2 that was emitted when the biofuels were burned.
Okay, he shared a lot there, Jeff Cooper, but I'll just give you the floor here. Take a minute or two and just share where you feel he's wrong.
Sure. Well, the 37% number he's talking about is looking only at new growth, and he said at the very beginning of that soundbite that existing corn acres are already pulling CO2 from the air, and that's exactly right. The problem is, though, he's not counting that carbon uptake. So the existing base of corn acres that are taking in carbon as that corn grows, he's assuming that isn't happening. He's assuming those corn plants are not sequestering CO2 from the atmosphere, and that turns the entire accepted conventions for carbon accounting on their head. I think it's very important folks to understand the differences between the carbon cycle for biofuels and the difference for, you know, the carbon cycle of fossil fuels. With a crop like corn that's being used to produce energy, you know, that crop is rapidly absorbing CO2 from the atmosphere as it grows. You convert that corn into ethanol, and the same amount of CO2 that it sucked from the atmosphere is then returned to the atmosphere when that biofuel is burned. So really what you have with biomass is a very rapid recycling of atmospheric carbon. You know, it's carbon that's already present in the atmosphere, and it moves periodically from oceans into plants and into soils and then back into the atmosphere, but you're not kind of uncorking carbon that's been sequestered underground. Whereas with fossil fuels, that's exactly what you're doing.
You're introducing a new source of carbon into the atmosphere.
Absolutely. Yeah. With biofuels, it isn't new carbon. It's carbon that's been floating around in the atmosphere, and it might have been in soils for a little while and in plants for a little while and oceans for a little while, but it's part of that atmospheric cycle. With fossil fuels, you're taking carbonaceous material that has been locked up underground for millions or hundreds of millions of years, and when you burn that, you're venting new carbon into the atmosphere. And that's what's fundamentally changing the balance of carbon, in our atmosphere and contributing to climate change.
Jeff Cooper is with the Washington, D.C.-based Renewable Fuels Association. We're discussing his disagreement with a recent study from the University of Michigan Energy Institute about carbon uptake and biofuel emissions. I was curious about John DiCicco's comments, though, about computer models. And I don't know how closely you look at these, but
sure.
I mean, we've heard in other areas, certainly in the climate discussion, computer models come up a lot. Just in forecasting the weather, computer models come up a lot. Can computer models include flawed data that distort research?
Oh, they absolutely can. And we've had our own concerns with a number of models that the government uses and that various academics use. Professor DiCicco himself used a computer model of sorts to do this kind of research. Models are just tools. And what really matters is the data that we put into these models and the quality of that input data and those assumptions. In the case of Professor DiCicco, we think he made some very bad assumptions. That's not to say the Department of Agriculture data that he used is flawed in any way. We rely on that same data for a lot of the analysis we do. But, you know, the models he's specifically referring to are managed by the Department of Energy. They've been used, you know, by practitioners around the world for the last couple decades. And the data that goes into those models is real-world, you know, empirical data that's collected by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and other entities. So
I know.
In many cases, we're using the same data, just applying it in a different way or making some different methodological choices.
I know biofuel advocates largely subscribe to the results of a study done by the Department of Energy, the Argonne National Laboratory,
mm-hmm.
claiming that ethanol, for one, reduces greenhouse gas emissions by an average of 34% over their life cycle. Is this a study that people in that biofuel proponents point to? And can you talk to us about that? What was the takeaway
Sure.
from that study?
Yeah, and there really are a number of studies that have reached similar conclusions, but the Argonne study you mentioned is a good one. And it looks not just at the uptake of carbon by the corn plant and then the release of carbon at the tailpipe, but it also looks at all the CO2 emissions associated with the production of biofuels, because, as you know, there's energy used to plant and grow and harvest the corn. There's energy used at the ethanol plant to make it into a liquid fuel. You got to get it from the plant to the gas station. So it looks at all of that, the entire life cycle of corn ethanol and kind of tallies up all those emissions. And at the end of the day, even assuming some of the same land use emissions that Professor DiCicco assumes, you end up with a number that's about 34% lower emissions than gasoline. There are other studies that say it's probably closer to 60%.
We've taken kind of a deep dive here into biofuels emission. I'd like to get back up off planet Earth here just a little ways and ask you a 5 miles up kind of question. What's the most noticeable trend in the renewable fuels field just in the past year or two, let's say? What do you see happening out there that is really noticeable and noteworthy?
Well, I think what we're very excited about is we're seeing kind of the first generation biofuels industry, which is primarily corn ethanol, really experiencing a technological evolution of sorts. We have, you know, plants that were built 10 or 15 years ago that are adopting new technologies and new processes where they're making ethanol not just from corn starch, but also the cellulosic fractions of the corn plant, or, you know, what we consider to be kind of the residue or waste portions of the crop. So we're seeing, you know, facilities kind of move into a new generation of feedstocks, wastes and residues, and doing that economically even when we have, you know, fairly low oil prices.
All right.
So it's very exciting to see.
We want to thank our guest, Jeff Cooper of the Washington, D.C.-based Renewable Fuels Association. We've been talking about biofuel emissions and carbon uptake and what it all means. Jeff, thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Current State discusses Michigan's environment every Tuesday. Our segments and others about the Great Lakes environment can be found at WKAR.org and at GreatLakesEcho.org. Yefim Bronfman, one of the world's greatest living pianists, comes to Mid-Michigan this weekend. Current State's Jamie Paisley was able to speak with him briefly last week about a couple of appearances he'll be making. Hi, Jamie.
Hey there, Mark. And, you know, last spring when all those concert season performance announcements, they were made, you know, Mr. Bronfman's made me, personally, being an afternoon classical music host, made me the most excited. And the bonus is that he'll be appearing twice in Mid-Michigan and in two different capacities. First up, a solo recital at the Wharton Center on Sunday. But before that, on Friday, he'll be performing with the Kalamazoo Symphony under maestro Raymond Harvey, playing a piano concerto by Tchaikovsky. Not the wildly famous first piano concerto, but Tchaikovsky's second instead.
Well, I'm trying to make the second also famous because I think it deserves it. I think it's a fantastic piece, just as good as the first concerto, and it's really a marvelous composition that has not been played that often. And I was surprised that people were eager to have it. A lot of orchestras have never played it, you know, and I think it's nice to have a new cover to the repertoire.
When you're coming to the different sort of orchestras that you perform with, do you reach out to the maestros? For example, have you spoken beforehand with Maestro Raymond Harvey of the Kalamazoo Symphony about this?
Not yet, but we'll certainly hope to have a meeting with him before our first rehearsal. You know, that usually the meetings happen before the rehearsal. Well, some conductors don't like to have meetings at all.
Now, it's very possible that Yefim Bronfman's most widely seen appearance wasn't on a concert hall or a YouTube link, but rather on the silver screen.
The Disney artists wanted to create a short film based on Hans Christian Andersen's wonderful fairy tale.
And if you can't place that voice, it's Bette Midler from Disney's Fantasia 2000.
Here is Yefim Bronfman playing the Shostakovich Piano Concerto No. 2 and the Steadfast Tin Soldier.
You made an appearance in Fantasia 2000, introduced by the great Bette Midler, with the Shostakovich opening allegro of the second piano concerto.
Yes.
Is that something that you really strive to do, is bring classical music out of the concert hall and widen the audience?
You know, classical music is good, and it's better than people think sometimes. It's just how to introduce it to the wider audiences has always been on my mind. And I think that what Disney did was a remarkable achievement. I think he introduced the classical music to so many kids. So many families have always come to me and said, well, you know, my kids always watch you on Fantasia, you know, and they they love the story, and it's, I think it's a marvelous introduction. I wish they did more of that.
We're speaking with pianist Yefim Bronfman, ahead of a couple of appearances he's making in mid-Michigan this week. The first on Friday with the Kalamazoo Symphony playing Tchaikovsky's second piano concerto. The second of Mr. Bronfman's appearances will be on Sunday at the Wharton Center in East Lansing. This performance, though, isn't alongside a symphony. Instead, Bronfman will have center stage solo in a rather sweet program.
You know, every program has to have a reason behind it. I think that for this program, I wanted to explore the structure of suite. So I think every piece on the program is in a suite form. Bartok suite, I think Fuman Humoreska is definitely in a very, the same similar vein of structure, although it does not mark a suite, but it's certainly not a sonata form, so it qualifies as a suite for me because it has a lot of movements and they're not necessarily related to each other in that particular case. And then, of course, there is a Bergamasque suite, as you see, and then there is a three-movement suite from the Petrushka. So I think that's kind of the point of reference for me for that particular program. And I think that Debussy and Stravinsky have a lot in common, and in a way, Debussy and Schumann also have a lot in common. You know, I think Debussy was looking up to Schumann when he was writing this music, because it's very picturesque and very descriptive, and very much in the way in a language, impressionistic language, but in a very romantic way.
Rounding out Bronfman's Wharton Center program on Sunday of solo piano suites, or those multi-movement, fairly disconnected works, is a piece by Hungarian Béla Bartók, which is harmonically complex but masked by the simplicity of the folk music inspiration, one of Bartók's great loves.
It's very much inspired by folk music. And I think that is a very simple piece. I think that one can always say it's early Bartók, and yet it has a bite of his later compositions already in the second and third movement of this piece. It's a great prelude to a Schumann big work. It is written in the same key as a Schumann. It's a very melodious piece, you know, in spite of all the motoric background. A very romantic piece, I think.
Yefim Bronfman, appearing with the Kalamazoo Symphony, Friday, September 16th, playing the Tchaikovsky Second Piano Concerto. More information at kalamazoosymphony.com for that Miller Auditorium performance, as well as appearing Sunday, September 18th, at the Wharton Center on the Michigan State University campus for a solo performance with music of Bartok, Schumann, Stravinsky, as well as Debussy's Suite Bergamasque, including the famed Clair de Lune. More information about that performance at the Wharton Center Great Cobb Hall at whartoncenter.com. Yefim Bronfman, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's a wrap for Current State today. Tomorrow, Hannah's House of Lansing provides homeless, expectant mothers with shelter and support so they can gain the emotional, physical, and spiritual strength they need to raise their child or pursue an adoption plan if they choose. For Neighbors in Action, we'll speak with staff members of Hannah's House about their work. Plus, this Sunday night at MSU's Fairchild Theater, a new Spartan sound comes to the stage.
It's a world premiere for all of us. So.
It does look like an incredibly high-energy, effective piece to start the second half of the program.
The Beaumont Brass and Friends will unveil Spartan Fanfare. We'll have that tomorrow on Current State. Hope you can join us. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR.